Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yo!
Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
And Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hey, friends, it's me.
Gentlemen, I have gathered the council to discuss important matters.
Oh, thank goodness.
Good.
Matters of weirdness.
Such as, name one weird thing.
Yeah, and I'm tired of hearing all these things that are less weird than I would prefer.
Well, I'll give you a weird thing about a weird thing. Remember our talk about Planet Nine? You know, Planet Nine's this maybe something that's like, you know, up to like 10 times the mass of Earth at the outer edges of our solar system. We call it Planet Nine because some killjoys demoted Pluto, you know, to dwarf planet. So then we're like, oh, now we got this empty slot. And then so I think it's Michael Brown and Constantine Batygin. I may be pronouncing the names incorrectly at Caltech. Noticed there was a pattern in outer objects of the outer edge of the solar system, like I think like Kuiper Belt objects, et cetera, or Oort cloud, and noticed that, like, man, it's like something's pulling on them. And they did the math and they said, you know what? It looks like there could be a massive planet way out the outer edge of our solar system, right? And this is, if you go look at the astronomical data, it's very compelling. It's very, very compelling. And for the longest time, they're like, hey, there's this anomaly. You know, just random noise doesn't seem to explain why these objects are being pulled in this one particular direction. And finally, somebody's come up with a suggestion other than there being a planet.
Oh, that's wild. I mean, what else could it be? I got nothing.
A black hole?
Our chat room's going, spiders?
It's always spiders.
I mean, listen, no matter what, you always find a way to bring a bag there. So, this is a pretty long loop, but I got a suspicion with them you're going to figure out a way to put eight legs or fangs on this sumbitch.
Actually, some researchers are suggesting, oh, maybe it's a ring. A ring of debris could possibly explain it.
Oh, that's interesting. So this would all be stuff that we would never see on a telescope, right? Debris or dust?
Well, it may be if you know exactly where to look and you're able to notice some sort of occlusion or something like that.
But it would take something like a Kepler-level dedicated satellite to try to spot that, to see those exact moments.
They're trying to use the Subaru telescope in Hawaii to spot Planet Nine. It's an interesting read. It's a theory. I'm still leaning towards it's a planetary body because the researchers are like, hey, it's great that there's an alternative theory out there. Here's the problem. Why would that ring stay formed like that out there? How did it form, et cetera? And it's an alternative explanation, but it's an even, from their point of view, the physics of it even more complicated than just saying, yeah, there's a planet out there.
So I guess it would be, first of all, like an answer either way would be exciting, full stop. But it's not like we're going to go visit Planet Nine. And now it's like, it's not like we're halfway to Hawaii. We found out, like, sorry, kids, there is no Hawaii. Turns out it's just an archipelago of a billion tiny islands. Emotionally, it's I guess it doesn't change any excitement to solve the mystery.
Well, you're clearly not a Caltech astronomer. I hear your point, but like if you go back to the image Bryce put up there, you know, the thing that I think is exciting is that the more we realize that our solar system's not just this flat sort of, you have nine objects and that's the end of it, where we realize like, no, it's way bigger. The archipelago idea, I like that because it means if you want to expand outward into the universe, going from here to Mars to, you know, Europa.
Oh, that's interesting because a giant supermassive gas rogue planet would be, I mean, maybe useful to orbit around if you wanted to set up a space station over there. But if it's all debris, let's say a bunch of Manhattan-sized asteroids, then that's pretty useful. That's a lot of easy to access minerals and things to hollow out and make a place for our biological infection to spread.
If there's a planet out there, odds are more than likely, based on what we know, it has moons. And some of those moons could be big moons. Even Pluto, you know, has orbits with an object. You know, the only planet in our system that doesn't have a moon is Venus, or excuse me, Mercury, rather. Mercury and Venus, rather. Mercury and Venus don't have, but other than that, the further out you go.
You're like the astronometric optimist. Like, no matter what, you've got good news.
I'm just saying, you know, Mr. Jeff Bezos wants to have, you know, millions of people living and working in space. They got to live somewhere.
Yeah.
Or just floating in space. I don't know. We need to ask him. He needs to clarify that for us.
Yeah. Somebody get him on the horn. Jeff, you got a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah. Now, in another interesting development, remember we talked about last year, Swarm Technologies, they had wanted to launch like a little constellation of satellites, right? And they went to the FCC. They're like, hey, we want to launch a little constellation of satellites. And the response was like, hey, no, this is, not sure if you're able to track these. We have a problem with this. You cannot do it. Swarm's like, okay, all right, cool. It's all right. And then they had a launch set out with an Indian company, and they basically used maybe a subsidiary or something to that effect and launched them anyways. And then the FCC is like, man, there's a lot of communications going between this company in America and these satellites. I'm like, is it you, Swarm Technologies? It's like, uh-oh. So they got caught and they got fined.
For launching, like, have they already launched these? Or they still want to? Or they got like halfway?
No, they launched them. They were up in space. That was the problem. They went ahead and launched them anyways.
Wow.
They were denied the permit from the FCC, but Swarm went ahead and basically they used an unaffiliated company in India to get around the restrictions, but was caught when the satellites transmitted to a station in back in the U.S.
Wow. And so the issue here is that would it have been a different story if they had just totally decamped and were operating out of India?
Yeah, I mean, if they weren't an American-based company, then it would be a different situation, but they're still an American-based company, so they are beholden to American laws applying to these things.
So they tried to have their cake and eat it too. They got a no from the U.S. government, and so they contracted through a subsidiary to do it in India, but I guess hoping that eventually the mood would change in the FCC?
I think they're maybe, let's see what we can get away with, you know, because I think they had a lot of venture capital invested in it. They were at a point where they needed to get this thing done, and all of a sudden the FCC is like, no. And perhaps for very good reasons, we don't know. I mean, I don't know the particulars of it, but it is a very interesting, you know, we've talked about kind of the maverick age of space, you know, space now.
I got to be honest, I'm impressed that any U.S. government institution would even have that much ability to, you know, to cause trouble. I guess the fact that they're, you know, based in America gives some leverage, and it should have been obvious. But I'm impressed they were able to even fine them $1 million and get some kind of acknowledgement of authority in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, what, you know, the question begs, some people are like, well, is the fine too low? It was $900,000. It's not crippling for Swarm Technologies.
Well, I think some argue you probably wouldn't be. Even a bad actor, even a naughty boy can be, you know, they want to correct them, not destroy them. Mm-hmm. Right.
That is hopefully the direction that's going into, because I think what Swarm is working on is very interesting. And we see that in a lot of disruptive companies like Airbnb and Uber and whatnot, where where is the line between, hey, government is being unnecessarily intruding on what we're trying to do, or no, government's doing what it's supposed to do. You guys don't know what you're doing, or you guys are taking risks you shouldn't be taking. And so, the point is that we just saw a graph there. They were able to raise $25 million after the FCC fine. And so the idea is that, hey, we paid our fine, we learned our lesson, and now we've raised $25 million in funding.
Well, because now they're the industry leader, right? like they did the thing that was technically illegal. They eat the $1 million fine, but after they get right with Uncle Sam, they're still the guys that did the thing in a world where nobody else did the thing.
How on earth do you keep that quiet to your investors? To like ostensibly you're a company that does a thing. Do you tell your investors like everything's fine, on schedule, the things are up in the sky?
You know, it's a great question, and it may be a, you know, they looked at it and said, what are the risks of doing this? And they're like, yeah, we know that the record fine we've seen for this is $1 million, and they're going to want to follow you more closely. And they might be like, okay. Or it might be that they're like, hey, we're going to use this Indian company, the subsidiary or the launch company there. So we're technically going to say we're not responsible for it and hope that maybe we loophole our way through it. And then it failed. And they're like, wah, wah.
Yeah, I think that for them, it's kind of a win-win. Like, either they continue to get this experience by, and it's for whatever reason, a hole in the sheet legal, right? Or, you know, I guess they were at the mercy of a much larger fine or something that would, you know, preventative actions being taken from the FCC that would prevent them from operating in the future. But short of that, they pay the fine and they are now, you know, publicly certified by the government to be doing a thing that is very, very, very valuable. That could be, you know, a microwaved telecommunications company, or even the backbone that you could sell, you know, to telecoms that want to lease it. So that is a gigantic possible market. So it's I don't know. I mean, I think that you have Andrew's point earlier about, there is a new level of venture capitalism that understands, with the runaway success of companies like Uber and Airbnb, that this, you know, innovation that requires you paying fines isn't quite the deal breaker that it might have been in the past. You know, when you know, Mark Cuban likes to tell a story about how his greatest investment, a missed investment, was Uber. Because he had previously invested in a Travis Kalanick company. And Mark Cuban's point was like, it's just going to take, you're going to be hung up in red tape getting these licenses city by city forever. It's just going to, you're going to burn through all your money, not realizing that, oh no, you just run and you wait for them to shut you down. And then immediately you have all the press you need, and you have the righteous anger of people that are annoyed that they can't get a cheaper ride from here to there. So for this, I think, you know, this is a much larger example. Now you're dealing with the federal government, and there are a lot of agencies that have dominion over space that you probably would not necessarily want to cross in the same way that you would, let's say, the local government of the city of Miami. But at the end of the day, it's you know, it seems like it worked out for them. They wound up raising $25 million after this press release.
Yeah. So it's... just, I bring it up as, hey, we're moving into this era where people are going to be able to move fast, break things, and the fear is, you know, we don't want people to break things that can't be unbroken.
Yeah, I guess that's the, you know, it sounds like this was a lucky best case scenario for Swarm, right down to the fact that they, you know, deployed the whatever, but man, things could have gone a different way. My guess is there was probably a legitimate reason why the FCC denied them permission.
Yeah, I mean, you get into the FCC's concern is the ability to track these objects, you know, like, can you track where you put these things up there? And that's one of the concerns now, some of the smaller, you know, CubeSats, is that you put these things up there, and if you lose track of them, they can be a hazard. And generally, CubeSats are designed now, or most of the orbits you can do are, you're supposed to basically in 30 days collapse, you know, into, you know, the Earth's atmosphere. So that's generally sort of the goal there, but that's not the case for everything. So fun times. You know what else is fun? Doing this show.
Hey, oh, yeah, man. Justin Young here to tell you about patreon.com/weirdthings. Yes, I said patreon.com/weirdthings. Folks, we like to do it the old-fashioned way, by you giving us money over the internet. And we do that with the good folks at Patreon. You know, if you go ahead on over to your family's computer and enter in patreon.com/weirdthings into a web browser, you're going to be able to support this show. And what does that mean? Brian, what does the support of America and the world mean to you?
I mean, it's worth approximately 35 trillion cubits of latinum. It's the most valuable thing I can possibly imagine. So while you may only be giving a dollar per episode, know that in emotional terms, you are the richest person in the planet.
Yes. Be the richest person on the planet by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. Disclaimer, rich means rich in spirit and not in money.
Because technically you'll be less wealthy for
wealthy yeah. in money, more wealthy in spirit by going to patreon.com/weirdthings, supporting this show and also getting early access to After Things, our show we do after Weird Things where we talk about business and creation and everything in between.
Speaking of everything in between, I have another story for you here, gentlemen. Question.
All right, go.
So a friend of mine who actually I'm going to go speak at his class in a couple hours, which I doubt any of them are listening to it because it's supposed to be a little surprise. His name is Paul Hynek, and his father was Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and there's now a TV show on History Channel, Project Blue Book, starring Aidan Gillen from Game of Thrones. Oh, you heard about the show?
No, I've not seen the show, but I am familiar with Project Blue Book, the big chasing UFOs stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now this show,
all I know about this show is seeing your Instagram and the awesome photo booth they set up at the premiere.
Oh yeah, that was pretty cool. So what's interesting is that the show basically takes some of the more sensational sort of stories and then spins them off into their own kind of narrative. So it's not a fact based, this is what happened. It's like, hey, let's take this and sort of do a what if kind of story about this. And you know, what's interesting is every time UFO conversations come up, and I went to the one of the premiere parties for this, and I got to talk to the guy who's head of MUFON, which is the one of the UFO research groups, and some other nice people. And you know, I come from a more skeptically inclined background, we'll put it this way. And you know, my mindset on these things is that, and I think we probably all share this, is that we're really bad at recognizing what we're very good at constructing narratives about what we see. We're very bad at reconstructing what we saw precisely. And
yes,
you know, so you know, I don't, you know, somebody says, oh, they saw a UFO, I'm not going to call them a liar. You know, I'll tell you what I did at the supermarket yesterday. It's probably a lie because, you know, I didn't go down that aisle or I got that the week before, whatever. So it's interesting though, because I've had numerous times where I've had conversations with people who I would consider extremely sincere and extremely credible. At one point I talked to a couple of years ago, had a driver in a car who actually used to be an Air Force pilot. He used to fly escort for SR-71s. And this guy had fascinating stories about like them, you know, intercepting objects, at, like being, you know, told that there is things at 100,000 feet, which, you know, they couldn't go attack, but, you know, basically saying that there was like told to intercept objects, things like this that behave strangely, whatever. You talk to pilots and you hear crazy, weird stories. So my question is there maybe something out there?
Define something. Like
something could be that my rationale, my belief is that there are phenomenon that we recognize, some that we don't. There's all sorts of interesting upper atmospheric phenomenon we're just beginning to understand, as far as the way, you know, particular kinds of lighting effects, things like this. You get things called trolls and plasma effects, et cetera, things like this. But, you know, and you talk to UFO people, and a lot of them aren't really like, they're not, not all of them are like, oh, it's aliens. A lot of them are like, oh, it's interdimensional. You know, oh, it's this.
I see what you're putting up. Like, we get it. Finally, you're landing it, and you're going to reveal that it's spiders.
Spiders, of course.
Yeah. Man, I got to tell you, I'm utterly predisposed. I've spent so much time learning about what flawed wetware human beings are, and I hold very, very little account for stories. I hold very mm-hmm. little value in the eyewitness tales. I and again, it's not that anybody's out to get you or that you have to complain, oh, you're calling me a liar. It's like, no, you could believe something and not be lying when you tell it. And then, and plus also, you know, if you could point to anomalous either recordings or whether it be of, you know, visual phenomenon or instrument recordings or whatever, it's already an acknowledged fact that instruments, you know, stuff happens. And there are a lot of really interesting genuine phenomenon that happen, that get recorded, and they show up at first as anomalies, and then we figure out what happens, stuff like, you know, solar flares and so on. But in general, man, I just go to there's a lot of gravitational weight around that Occam's razor of when you know that there's a 99.99% chance that nobody's remembering the story correctly, then that's, it's really hard to escape from that gravity well to go to the Planet Extraordinary for me. But again, that's my bias, because I just tend to look at the human side of things.
Yeah, I tend to, I mean, like, are there things out there? Sure. Let's say that there are things out there. I don't know how much I'm into the idea. The further we get, the older I get, and the further we get into our modern technological world, the more I think the archetype of the, like, coquettish, shy alien that just wants to, like, pick off the fringes of our herd is kind of a myth of the analog era, of a bygone era where so much more was, you know, even compared the 70s, let alone the 50s or the 40s, to now, and understand how much of our world was recorded through oral tradition, even in broadcasting and mass media. I tend to think that seems more and more convenient the further that we get out. So I think the expeditionary alien that we understand, I think, seems a little sillier and sillier as days go by. But as for what's out in the great beyond, I mean,
oh, anything's on the table. Yeah, but the I was really struck by I like where your head's at in terms of, you know, the deeper into the Cold War era you go, the more humans are involved at all points in the system, and the less fidelity we have, and the more we rely on memories and storytelling. I was really struck watching First Man that like, pilots nowadays send someone up in a spaceship, a pilot's there, I guess, just in case something goes wrong. But back then, like, pilot was the only way to do it. You had to have a pilot correct the spinning around and landing, yeah, and aiming, yeah, and all that stuff.
First Man, which I did really enjoy. I was sad to see it not get award recognition, but man, if there is a monument to show how much of a science fair experiment our initial trip to Mars was, in our entire proto space program, you owe it to yourself to go see it, just to watch every rickety bucket of bolts go up and creak, and the brave men that figured that out.
I bring this up because I want to be guarded on my own skepticism, and I, you know, I think we all sort of feel the same way, that we see so much of how easy it is for people to misinterpret things. As people in magic, we do something one day, and a week later people regale us with something they saw that we know is not what they saw.
Or even describing the exact trick that, you know, I know how I did it, and what you're describing is not possible. But
yeah, using my own example, I look for my own examples of where I failed to be a good observer. And I think I'm a good observer. I think overall I try to be an accurate observer, but I know I fail. And so using my own self is sort of a test, going like, hey, I make these mistakes all the time. I have to assume, you know, other people I speak to, and often people I find the more extreme the thing they observed, I would say that other observations in their life imply they're not the most credible observers. But you don't want to discount somebody and say, oh, no, but I think that it would seem that there would be so much more evidence. That's the thing it comes down to, is there just be so much more evidence for these things.
Well, and I think it was Steven Spielberg, and we've mentioned this on the show before, but back when he was doing press junkets and tours for when he redid War of the Worlds, his position on UFOs had changed, because during Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he was like, yeah, I believe it. I'm for it. I think it's a thing. And then War of the Worlds, he's like, well, the number of cameras has increased geometrically, exponentially, by factors of 1,000, 10,000, 100,000. And yet the number of reported photos algorithmically going down. And so it seems like if there is something out there, the clearer your vision, the better you would be able to see it, not the reverse. And that's a frustrating thing to get around.
Yeah, you know, you go pick up one of the old like UFO guides or from the 1970s or 80s, and the different photos and illustrations people did of the majority of the ones you look in there, and you go, all right, if you ever live near an airport or stand near a place where you see planes take off, and you look at all the different angles of which you see planes, and you start looking at this, you're like, plane, 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 plane.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, man, yeah, oh, let's, yeah, we saw this long silver streak with these windows and a red and a blue light. Oh, God, I wonder, you know, because.
Well, and also, if you've ever seen a plane aiming, like headed right towards you coming in to approach, it looks like the classic stereotypical flying saucer. Mm-hmm. It is a straight line with the little bulbous part in the middle, and same thing for that fuselage, especially like American Airlines, where it's all silver. That thing catches the sun at sunset. Yep. It is just this beam of light frozen in place. It's remarkable.
Yeah, and I remember watching. I was in Santa Monica with our friend Mary. We're walking along. We're pre-production for some show, and we look out there and we see these lights way beyond the ocean, just hovering. And I'm like, let's watch. This is fascinating. Cause like, I'm like, what is that? Cause it looked like, you know, I'm thinking a helicopter, but it was a helicopter that far out to sea. And we waited, and it took like 15 minutes. And finally we saw, once it curved in for LAX, it was an airplane. But from the direction we're at, it looked like this massive body hovering, because, and the same effect that like why the moon looks bigger, depending on what part of the sky it is relating to buildings, were getting that same effect where this thing looked huge, you know, and you know, that's, you know, anyhow, we're willing to be shown. But I sent Bryce a link to, it's kind of cool, sprite lightning, which is a very cool, you know, effect where you look at some of these examples of some of it just looks like glowing. But like the top one is pretty cool. The red one.
Wow.
You know,
So it looks like man, according to this this scale, although it would be difficult to really know how far it goes, but this looks like kind of a ghostly jellyfish or mushroom cloud, mm-hmm. a gaseous anomaly, 20 kilometers tall. Is that right?
Upper atmosphere. So yeah, it could be that tall. You know, these things can stretch all the way from the thermosphere to the stratosphere.
And do they hang around for a long time, or about as long as a lightning strike, or what?
I think they're just about as long as a lightning strike. Okay. But you know, we know we get some other phenomena that last a little bit longer. And there's a lot of like upper atmospheric stuff just fascinates me, because there's just a lot we don't know. You know, we're very good at studying what happens with, you know, 30,000 feet or so, because that's where airplanes are. But if you look at some of the images they have, are like from they show a sprite over Laos, one of the third image down or fourth image down, taken from the International Space Station. And you look at, when you're looking down at these objects, which would be awesome if we had more ways to observe and to see these things.
Yeah.
So you see the lightning and the sprite right above there.
Wild.
So the sprite, like, yeah, looks like it's this reddish jellyfish sort of thing that appears for momentary during the lightning thing. And that's, you know, there's some speculation about, you know, is lightning, do we fully understand how it's caused? Because is there a trigger? Can it be triggered by cosmic rays? Are there other effects to it? Is it just simply what we think of, like, you know, an electrostatic differences, or does it need a trigger, or can it be triggered, etc.?
So visually, this thing looks like a picture a disk of clouds, right? And then imagine lightning striking in the middle, and as if you've ever seen the visual of ejecta from a black hole, you know, it looks like plasma shooting out of a black hole above a lightning strike.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, what is people in the chat room are talking about ball lightning. Did we ever get a definitive answer on what that is?
So we've been able to recreate ball lightning in the laboratory.
Well, what is the description of it? Because I've heard so many wildly different descriptions.
Well, it might be a variety of phenomenon, but basically you're talking about a small or a large ball-shaped energy of like plasma, okay? So you get something that gets, you know, some people say, you know, bits of dust or something gets superheated into a plasma and it's cohesive for a few seconds. It can bounce around, et cetera. So that seems to be, you know, as far as what we think that is. So how it's caused, we can create in the, you know, we can create it, you know, like I said, we can create it in the lab or something that appear, you know, seems to have the same effect. But what's been observed in, you know, out in nature, maybe that same thing. It may be, you know, high electrical discharge, you know, turning something into a plasma that.
Ooh, another good question. What is St. Elmo's fire?
St. Elmo's fire was the when ships were at sea and they would see the electrical discharge at the top of the mast. So basically it's like your ship or whatever to be like acting kind of like a Van de Graaff generator.
Oh, yeah. Because everything's supercharged like right before a storm or something like that.
Yeah, that's what St. Elmo's fire was.
And, everything's, you know, crackling.
An iconic movie of the 80s.
Yeah.
let's look at, yeah, but remember St. Elmo's. That's, you know, it's all these different sort of, you know, phenomenon, you know, which are, a coronal discharge from a sharper pointed object. And so the example this shows a ship at sea and it be discharged off the top. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So basically, imagine the boat is you shuffling your feet across shag carpet. Mm-hmm. Only you have spindly metal fingers, and out of them is you know, zapping. Yeah, like in the background of a monster horror movie from the 1950s. Yeah. Sort of just electricity tendrils.
Yeah. Between that and you think about you know, there are certain times, there have been periodic times where the aurora borealis has been visible much more in lower altitude or lower latitudes. You know, that's been kind of an interesting phenomenon. And then you talk about like at night where you could see, glowing plankton and et cetera. And you get, you know, all these sorts of things. We sort of forget all the luminous things around us.
I told this story, must have been 5 years ago, I think, but my friend CJ Johnson called me and he was like, all right, look, as you're my resident skeptic, I need you to talk me through what I'm seeing, because I'm looking at a light in the sky that is so much brighter than
aliens.
Any stars. And I'm seeing it. I'm watching it right now over my house move up and down and left and right. It'll stay in place for a while and then move again. And then through a series of questions, I reminded him that, like, okay, well, you know, a lot of those mystery spots where water seems to go uphill, they work because there's been a landslide and all the trees have kind of tilted or shifted. As a result, because you unconsciously use those trees as a frame of reference, now it looks like the water's going up because all the trees are kind of tilted off to the side. Likewise, an object that is static in the sky can appear to move if you're looking at it between a canopy of trees, because you know, let's say all the there's no wind and then the trees are all still, and then there's a slight wind, whether you know it or not, you're using those leaves and branches as a frame of reference. So as they sway gently back, left, right, up, down, or whatever, it's going to make it look like the bright light goes up and down. And then I was like, okay, let's talk about the light. Is it a point of light, or can you detect it as a disc or what have you? And he was like, no, it's a point of light. And it was fun because this is all pre-internet before, or I guess not pre-internet, but early internet, where it was not easy to just pull open a web browser and find this. But I happen to have the Starry Night software on my laptop at the time. This is what, 15 years ago? And I fired it up and I went to his location and I looked up, and exactly where he was describing, I was like, good news, you've discovered Jupiter. You're looking at Jupiter. But I'm sure it was an electrifying experience. And I think that's part of the attraction. You know, in a pre-internet days, let's say post-campfire but pre-internet, I think there's something that we all want with a good ghost story, with a good tickling of the senses, something to give you goosebumps and make you wonder, you know, what's out there, the mysterious and the unknown. And I remember watching all of those, you know, In Search Of, any special that had UFOs or ghosts or any of that stuff. I think that's a universal need of humanity. And in a post-internet days, it's interesting to see that bubble up in different ways, because even if you're a skeptic, you dive into like creepypastas and these stories of like, there's no way to know. Like, we want them to be in Schrodinger's box so that we can't ever know if they're true or not. But we get that delightful goose flesh from hearing those stories.
Yeah. It's harder now. I don't know, to be a sincerely open-minded critical thinker and accept a lot of these things, in my opinion, and I may be offending a lot of people, and I apologize. When I was a kid, I wanted to know about UFOs and ghosts. I went to the library, and most of the books written on ghosts and UFOs were written by people who, guess what, said they are real, because that's who bought most of those books. And you'd read about these accounts, and you're like, I have no way to refute this. Like, I guess, you know, somebody says this. And then in the age of the internet, the skeptical voice and people who are saying, well, here's the thing, when they say this house was haunted, whatever, what they failed to mention was, you know, there was a teenage son there who'd been arrested for blah, 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 you know, or this UFO story, this photo that you saw there was actually airbrushed in, we know this, or this guy who saw these UFOs, they found a barn where he had a bunch of UFO models, you know, and you get these other, and you realize, like, now that extends to sort of documentary television and stuff, too, where you watch stuff and you're like, oh, I know people involved with this. This was a lie, you know, but... Yeah, I think it's easier. I kind of figured out that kind of as a skeptics, we sort of won when the World Wide Web came about, because if you want to find out, you can find out. You can find out what intelligent people have to say about it.
Although nowadays, you know, it's interesting because there was a time when, we'll say right around and before the turn of the century, when there was people getting the word out about pseudoscience, about like, hey, this is flawed for this reasons. Here's what you don't know, this research or whatever. And then there was the, you know, the Snopes era of being able to Google things and get a skeptical take instantly. And now it's interesting. It seems like we're in a post capital T truth era. And now where it's like, no. I want to believe they're aliens. I don't want to hear or see anything that tells me otherwise. Let me just like the appropriate things. And yay, now I live in a world where that's a fact, and that's the end of it.
Well, I think that there is that element of our curiosity, but there's also that desire for the story, right? There's that desire to understand, like, okay, well, who are these people? How are they reacting to it? Like, what happens after the alien shows up? These kind of like great sort of like storytelling tropes that we can sort of digest in a different way in bite-sized formats.
There's also like that if you spent a large part of your life embracing an idea that's non-conventional or unconventional that other people don't accept and telling people this and having people call you, well, that's a little nutty, I don't think that's real, whatever, you're really invested in not losing your faith in that. You know, you stand, because if you find out all of a sudden, like, oh no, yeah, that guy who you claimed that evidence was real, we found out was a hoax, you don't really want to, you know, like, you're nobody wants to find out that, you know comic book man, oh my god, I wasted my life, you know. And that's, you know, I guess it's part of it. Like, I try to be sympathetic towards that, because, like, I've gone, you know, we go to some of these groups and talk to people who believe ardently in, you know, UFOs and Bigfoot and stuff. And it's like, there is no room in their worldview that they could be wrong. And that's the thing that I find. I'm willing to accept that I could be wrong. I'd love to find Bigfoot. I'd love to find this UFO stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. We're would be pumped. Like, if anything, we're trying to pre-disappoint ourselves for how excited we would be if some of this stuff were we could find proof of it.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, we do picks?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I got a pick. So, well, I don't know which one I want to do here, which one I want to do in after things. But I watched all but the final episode, or what I think is the final episode, because Hulu's system is so weird, of the second season of Future Man.
Oh, shoot. Cool. How is it?
Man, does it get off to a slow start. I was kind of ready to tap out on it. 4 or 5 episodes in, and then it kind of gets back to what I think its strength is, which is the team being together, going through a complicated, at times overcomplicated, conspiracy that involves time travel. You know, that I think is when it is clicking, and even when the satire that it wants to bring to the science fiction genre, is kind of brought to the fore. And at times it gets a little bit too wackety schmackety, like, look, this is like that other movie. And I think it's when it gets away from the fact that we really like these characters and we want to see these characters kind of evolve and play off each other and, you know, come together and turn apart and do all that. So it gets to there, but man, I got to scratch my head at some of the choices they made at the beginning of the season.
Well, I am loath to admit that I did not finish the first season. I think I had maybe 2 episodes left, but not knowing whether or not this was a one and done, never going anywhere thing, as I got closer to the end, I became more fearful of investing, you know, my time in something that wasn't going to go anywhere. And then then there was that middle period of like, oh, there's going to be a second season. I should get around to watching those. And then it's like, I'll watch it when the second season comes out. And then the second season comes out. And then it's like, well, let me find out if it's good. And so as a result, like, I'm glad to hear that it ends up somewhere. But it sounds to me like, does it get a benefit from binging, I assume?
I would probably have stopped watching it if I had to watch if I had to wait a week between those first 4 episodes. I'll tell you that for sure. So it is benefited in that by the end of those first 4, I was like, okay, well, maybe next episode things will start cooking. And then I did that 3 times, which if it weren't one of those like Friday night, we're just, you know, me and Ash are just sitting around, like we're either watching TV or we're going to sleep, I probably would have made another decision, but I stuck with it and I'm glad I did, because there is some really, really fun, cool kind of like science fiction-y and time travel kind of storytelling that they like to do. And I think they're good at it. When they're not,
when they're good.
I don't want to spoil much. Andrew, I think I remember you saying you watched it, right?
Yeah, I watched it. And funny thing, Brian, I watched Future Man season 1 on your recommendation, how much you're enjoying it.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it beyond words.
So you're like, man, I'm going to give up 2 episodes later. But I dug by the time I got to the end of the first season, I enjoyed it. There's strengths and weaknesses, but the strengths are so great. It was such a fun show. The second season, you know, I totally agree the pacing for this, because it's sort of like, it's like, man, we're spending a lot of time in this storyline and I'm bored. We could just move right along, and it's not, and it feels like, a writer's room that was heavily disorganized and filled with, you know, smoke. That there was a lot of cool ideas there that never got a lot of structure to them. And that's sort of the problem. Cause like on the surface, like, hey, cool, a Mad Max-esque thing and this sort of thing, which, you know, we got a little bit of that, but you know, I kind of feel like this is a show that now kind of has to compete with Rick and Morty.
Yeah, 100%. In fact, there are moments in which, you think about like, okay, this is a time travel story that is definitely trying to seize on time travel-y tropes, right? And so yeah. Back to the Future and Terminator, and you kind of realize like, oh, wow, you know, Rick and Morty can kind of just parachute into an episode and be like, yeah, here's, we're going to make fun of Inception, and then we're out, right? Yeah. Here's, we're going to make fun of these kind of movies or this kind of plot, and then we're out. We can be very meta about it, and that's it. Whereas, like, to me, the times that I found myself the most bored were either A, when we were in plot lines that I just was like, okay, we get it, let's move it along, or when they were transparently just kind of stapling on some satire for the sake of it. Like, there's this is, you know, very minor spoiler. They have these like themes on top of episodes that are like about like a family sitcom or a very specific reference to a crime procedural. And it's like, for no reason, like literally not like, I mean, I don't know, maybe people more familiar with the crime procedural would, you know, get the subtleties more than just graphic cards. But I didn't think it was necessary for the story that I like. The story that I like has likable characters unraveling a crazy mystery while involving time travel. Like, get to the that. I like the that part.
Yeah, they just felt like I said, like, hey, these are some fun ideas that never kind of got strung together.
Yeah. But that being said, it's like once everything is kind of there on display, I think there's some good stuff there, and I really enjoy it. My favorite character of the season is Haley Joel Osment, and his character is, you know, continues from the first season in a really fun and interesting way, and I enjoyed his performance and the idea of his character.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. He's a delight wherever he shows up. And yeah. I and watch this. You'll enjoy it. At the end of this, you'll be like, hey, I'm glad I watched this. And I'm looking forward to season three.
Yeah, I you know, it was for the first time, I was noticing at the end of episodes, they would end episodes without a cliffhanger in the first half of the season. It would just be like, oh, here's a thing. And somebody, you know, got to the end of this episode arc. And then they're going to look onto the change that they made, and that'll be the end of the episode. And it's like, wait, no, you're the whole thing is that they're stuck in a place and they need to be going to the resolution. And by the end of the episode that I'm on now, it does what I think the first season did really effectively, which is like, all right, we're at the end of this. And now here's the little thread that gets you into this next episode of a mystery series. Cause at the end of it, it is a mystery series that they have to unravel how to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. So I got a pick. I went and saw that Glass movie, the new M. Night Shyamalan. Did any of you guys see it?
A very complicated history with this. I do have to ask if you went with your brother.
I did.
Okay. Because yeah. That was, for those of you who have not listened to Night Attack, Jay, who had a medical scare last year and was in a coma for a significant period of time.
Yeah.
One of the first things he said when he woke up was...
Was has Glass come out yet? And this is back over the summer. So I think both of us, then we saw the reviews, and both of us felt this like deep sense of obligation. It's like, well, we don't not see Glass together after that, right? I got to tell you, so have any of you guys seen it?
No. I didn't see it, no. I think as soon as I saw the 50th commercial and trailer where it was like a bunch of people running around outside the sanitarium, and I'm like, this isn't what I liked about Unbreakable, and this is the stuff that I like the least about Split.
I think that much like the movie Solo, and I'll never know in the other timeline what it looked like or felt like to see it in a vacuum, right? In a bubble. But I'm so glad that I heard all of the gripes everyone had about it going into it, or just at what point they fell off, because I didn't really get any spoilers. But you know, like, I heard that some people hated the whole thing. I heard that some people liked the first 75% of it or whatever. But the biggest thing, like, going into it with low expectations made me appreciate all the things that were delightful and the interesting touches that they do. If you are unfamiliar, the biggest key to enjoying Glass is to remember, it is a Blumhouse film. If you can not let go of that, if you can keep that at the forefront of your mind, and remember that the way Blumhouse works is that you are given complete creative freedom, and you are told, exactly how many dollars you get to spend and not one more, unless you want to pull it out of your own pocket, in which case, good for you. So you get a lot of scenes like, this set piece has a bunch of things that will do something very impressive if you try to cross me. And then it's like, oh, I'm going to try to cross you. Cut to exterior shot with sound effect of something very impressive mutedly happening inside. Then back inside to what appear to be the effects of something really interesting happening, right? Or likewise, you know, a person says, I've got a plan that involves this massive visual set piece and I'm going to enact it. And I'm like, no, you won't. this is a Blumhouse film. And it's like, if you could hold on to that, I think you'll enjoy it a whole lot more.
You know, it's interesting is the, I'm looking forward. I like Split. I love Unbreakable. Split was fun, but it wasn't like, but you know, this is a movie where the critics have 36%, but the audiences have given the 76%. So you're looking at like, it's a very different sort of take. And that's, you know, that's why at first I'm like, oh, I'm sorry to see it didn't. Well, I'm like, oh, people like it. People really like it. So, you know, let me go check this out.
I mean,
you know,
just remember, Blumhouse, and you're going to have a lot more fun.
Although yeah. I do think J.C. Calhoun does point out that M. Night, I think, works with Blumhouse as a distributor, but I think he finances the movies, or he has...
Sure. He finances them out of pocket.
No, I think that you wind up getting to the same point no matter what, which is that everyone's watching the bottom line, and no matter what this script is... The question for M. Night is, can he match his vision to his budget when it seems like he obviously had a very big vision for this story?
I will say, I don't think this is a spoiler, but you know, it's a sequel simultaneously to Unbreakable and Split. It uses footage from both of those movies to flash back to, which and blends it with story elements, which I thought really, you know, I don't know, was interesting. It's wild to like imagine the expense it would take to have Bruce Willis remember something that happened, you know, 15 years ago, and then you'd have to digitally, you know, de-age him or whatever. But instead, he's able to remember it 15 years ago, and they just use the footage from Unbreakable, and it ends up like that's one of the elements that I enjoyed. Again, you know, if you're thinking about it as a storytelling puzzle, and you're like, well, how are they going to not actually deliver on this, but instead tell a story? You know, there's a part that fall flat, but there's other successes.
Yeah, cool. Bryce?
You know, I haven't been watching too much stuff over the past week. I have been rewatching kind of in the background Schitt's Creek. I think I talked about this on the Killies on Cord Killers, but I am just in love with Schitt's Creek. It's a sort of ensemble sitcom. Ooh, excuse me, an ensemble sitcom from I think it's a CBC. I think it's a CBC original about this rich family who, after a tax issue, ends up all of their belongings possessed by the government, and they have to go and live in this small town that they bought as a joke for the son's birthday when he was a kid. And so they all move and live in this motel in Schitt's Creek. And it's a fun, kind of wholesome show, honestly. You actually see a lot of like character growth for the characters. They're not just like awful, vapid people the way that like Arrested Development kind of handles rich people.
Yeah, or although structurally it sounds like it's a similar space to Arrested Development, but just with it maybe more sincerity, or
I think because Arrested Development gives such a strong image of what you do with rich people in a storytelling thing, you look at Schitt's Creek and feel like it's very different from that. But it's also I also think it's probably a little more similar to just like a normal sitcom story, right? You know, you kind of have a wacky adventure every week, and there are some long running threads of, you know, boyfriends or girlfriends or family things, but it's a very light and legitimately funny show. I really dig it, and there are like three seasons of it on Netflix, and they're still making more up in Canada. So
right on.
Yeah, I think the one thing I really like about it in kind of treating these sort of rich people as out of fish out of water archetypes is that it still finds ways to show them as skilled people and not just like blundering, you know,
cartoon
rich
characters.
People. Right. You know, yeah. You're like, okay, well, you know, you're definitely in a environment that you're not accustomed to, around people that you probably wouldn't hang out with. But also you are able, you still are like a valuable person. You're not like a complete wastoid, you know, trust fund person. So I don't know. It feels very kind of humanizing in that way. And it's just like heartwarming. You know, it's a very like family. It is a mature comedy. There's mature language and stuff, but it's very like family, heartwarming sort of tales.
Cool.
Yeah. Andrew?
My pick is going to be a little odd. And it's one of the joys of like Hulu and some of these other services. You'll go through there and find shows or things like that that you forgot about or go like, oh yeah, let me go back and watch that. And a lot of them don't hold up, but sometimes you find there's a little charm to it. And I went back and I saw that Hulu had Sliders.
Oh yeah. How does it age? Please say good.
You know, the thing about the show Sliders is that, you know, you forget how much more expensive or how much more production quality goes into TV shows these days. You know, you watch shows now, sci-fi shows, things like this, and you realize that, like, man, we special effects have gotten so much more, and the business of TV has gotten more that you can have, because Sliders was on Fox initially. You know, the first few seasons were on Fox when it was, you know, an up and coming but a network, and then it went to sci-fi. But I mean, and you look at this, you're like, man, like this show looks like a low budget show. But you know, the writing in it was actually pretty good. And it was funny as I watched the first episode and I saw the director was listed as like, Andy Tennant. And I'm like, that looks familiar. I'm like, who's Andy Tennant? And then I'm like, oh, he directed a bunch of the Kaminsky Method episodes.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And then you go look at like some of the producers who worked on like Sliders. It'd be like John Landis, I think, you know, was like showrunner or working on or producing for a while, and some other people in there. So they do, you know, they had one episode where they show up in an alternate reality where a meteor is about to hit the Earth, right? And they kind of split up to do their own thing. And one of the stories, the crying man, Cleavon Derrick's character, he goes off and finds some people who are just going to party. They're just going to party. And he goes for this party and people are just going kind of, you know, playing music, whatever, having fun, like we're going to die, whatever. And then there's a couple throwing the party and then he follows them upstairs. And some people are playing Russian roulette.
Oh, geez.
You know, and it's sort of like they kind of do this like, man, they're like kind of exploring some sort of dark themes there, you know, and he grabs the wife, takes him with him to a church. So they're feeding people on the last days. It was just a little morality sort of play, kind of like, I go like, man, there's some neat sort of thinking that went into this show. You know, they go into one where, you know, the Earth is Soviet taking over, like we became, you know, a Soviet satellite state and stuff. And it gets, you know, a little bit into the politics of that in a way that like, oh, this is very interesting. This is very, very post Cold War Soviet Union breakup. We'll talk about it this way. But 10 years later, you wouldn't be addressed the same way. So anyhow, I've been enjoying it. So I thought, you know, it was a neat way to go about themes and, you know, deal with the challenges of production limitations. I find it, I've been very frustrated like lately with sci-fi that is just way too preachy, way, way, way too preachy. Like Star Trek Discovery just sort of drove me. I don't mind preachy if you're really nailing it as far as your execution. Discovery kind of just drove me nuts. Now Orville, I kind of like, but kind of got a little bit like that, you know, like, you're like, oh, how do you do money in our system? Our system is based on, you know, here we don't have money. We're based on reputation. And I'm like, man, did they just endorse the Chinese credit system? You know, so anyhow, I digress. Sliders, a simpler time.
I will vouch. Man, I remember really digging the first two seasons, or the first season was the most freewheeling when I realized I was so pleased when I was like, oh, they're not going to make any judgment. They're just going to play with different worlds. Like they're not necessarily there to save every world. Just take us on a tour of it. And then GTFO, yep. You know? And then they started setting up like, you know, Nemesis, whatever, that's where it ended up losing me. But those early seasons, man, I love them a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. It's been weird.
Lord. The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.